The Triathlon Show 251. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview James Sprague. James is a cycling coach with really great knowledge in both the scientific side and the applied side of cycling and coaching. He's himself a former professional cyclist, and he has coached cyclists from amateurs up to Olympic level, and he has taken cyclists to over 20 medals at national, European, and world championship levels. So we'll have a varied training talk today where we're talking about James' coaching philosophy, training structure, periodization, microstructures, when and why to select different types of training, and profiling an athlete, and so on, much, much more. But you'll hear about that when we get into the interview, which we'll do right after thanking our sponsors. First, you have Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. They make electrolyte supplements that you can match to your individual sodium losses. So your how much sodium you lose in your sweat depends on your sweat rate and your sweat sodium concentration. And the best way to figure out roughly where you stand in the sweat sodium loss department is to take Precision Hydration's free online sweat test on their website. And that consists of 10 questions in a quiz format, qualitative answers, multi-choice answers. So it's pretty easy, takes a few minutes, and that will give you a good ballpark estimate that has been validated with actual medical grade sweat testing equipment. Definitely a great starting point for you to then go and select what sort of electrolyte supplement strength you should use in training and racing. You can also get 15% off your products with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world-leading experts in wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. And the eyewear category with the prescription glasses, sunglasses, and so on is something that has been growing substantially in the last year or so. And some really cool new things that Roka has going on in that department is things like the online vision test that you can use to update your prescription from the comfort of your own home. They also have home try-on options for their glasses and many other things, although I should say that some of these things are only available in the United States. You can get 20% off your order of Roka products with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Coach James Sprague. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, James. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good, thanks. How about yourself?
I'm good as well, thank you. So let's start simply by you introducing yourself a bit to the audience and telling us about your background and what you're currently doing, your current role in sports.
Yeah, sure. So I guess I kind of got into cycling when I was probably 13, 14. Was kind of lucky enough to be picked up by British Cycling and went through their sort of talent development program. Didn't kind of make the cut at a certain age going into under 23s, and so went abroad and have lived abroad since, really. So I spent 10 years riding my bike full time, probably around 6 years as a professional, both on the road and cross. So not at the highest level on the road, but I still kind of, you know, rode semi-classics and kind of some big stage races and that sort of stuff. And then on cross, on the cross bike, competed at kind of a World Cup level. So stopped the end of my career was probably 3 years ago now. And then I went on to do a master's degree, in sports science. And now I'm back to start a PhD. In terms of coaching, so I started working with some riders while I was still obviously riding myself, and then have moved into kind of a more coach sports science role full time since the end of my career.
Right.
So that's a little bit about me, really.
Yeah, and I was going to ask the PhD that you're starting. What's the topic going to be?
So we're looking at the downward shift in the power duration curve in elite cyclists. So essentially, we've actually, with the group that I work with, we've just had a couple of papers accepted. And one of them looked at the differences between under 23 and professional cyclists during the Tour of the Alps stage race. And we also split those cyclists up into groups. So we had GC contenders, we had climbing domestiques, and we had more all-rounders. And we saw quite a distinct difference between the groups in how much power they can produce after defined workloads. So we looked at their maximum powers after 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, 2,500, and 3,000 kilojoules. And we saw, for example, in the all-rounders group, that we basically saw a downward shift in that power duration curve after each of those defined workloads. However, with the GC group, we didn't see that downward shift. And there was almost no difference even after 3,000 kilojoules between their maximal power duration curve and their power duration curve kind of under fatigue, if you like. So my PhD will be looking at why we see those differences between groups.
All right. Yeah, that sounds fascinating. And maybe once you have some more papers, or perhaps even the entire PhD finished, we'll have an in-depth discussion about that topic, because absolutely fascinating to hear about those things. But let's move a bit more into coaching for a while here. And I know this is a very broad question, but if you can give an overview of your main coaching / training principles, what would that be?
Yeah, okay. I think you always need a good evidence base for any decisions or interventions that you're going to make with an athlete. I guess, you know, I guess you'd call it kind of evidence-informed coaching. So in order to make good decisions, you need to have as much kind of information at your fingertips as possible. And I think a bit of a deep dive into the relevant kind of literature is always a good starting point. And I think understanding, you know, not only the outcomes and the conclusions of these studies, but also, you know, the nuances and the caveats is a really good way to at least sort of build up that evidence base. And then you start to get an understanding of maybe what will work with a specific athlete or the specific group, or what might not work, or the reasons why it may or may not work. And then I guess I see sort of coaching as the kind of, you know, the application of that knowledge to the individual athlete. And, you know, what works for them. So, you know, if you start with that good understanding, you can at least make good initial decisions. And then it's a case of, you know, applying that to the athletes, seeing what's working, seeing what's not working, and, you know, kind of then making further decisions from there. So I guess that's sort of my overall coaching methodology.
Yeah. Do you, off the top of your head, can you think of any sort of examples where athletes or even coaches get this process wrong, where they're like really working against the evidence-informed principles? Is there something common that comes to mind that you see a lot of time going wrong?
Yeah, I think athletes and coaches are bombarded with a lot of information, and it's often the case that people sort of get a bit distracted by what the kind of the, you know, the newest gizmo on the market or the newest study that's come out, or and they kind of, you know, focus solely on that, and that ends up distracting them from kind of doing the basics well. So, you know, I think the basics are 99% of what you do with an athlete. So, you know, train well, sleep well, and eat well, and do that consistently over time. That's where you're going to see the big gains, and all the best athletes get that right, and only then can you kind of, you know, exploit things the very, very margins of performance. So I think what the biggest mistake I see people making is, you know, something new comes out and they focus all their energy or all their decision making or whatever else on this new thing, and forget that, you know, that's actually a tiny, tiny piece of the puzzle. And, you know, getting those basics right of going out training every day, recovering well, eating well, sleeping well, they're the things that's going to, you know, bring an athlete on in the longer term, and actually, to be honest, in the shorter term as well.
Yeah, that's really great advice. And I was actually planning on asking this next question later on, but it fits quite nicely in here. So I'm going to ask you, for athletes that are interested in learning more and using the available science and research in their own self-coaching perhaps, or for coaches, budding coaches that want to get into it, do you have any sort of resources that you might recommend for them to get started and learn about the most important things, the fundamentals, and not so much get hung up on the latest shiny single study that shows something on an obscure topic.
Yeah, I don't actually think there's that many really good kind of single source resources out there. I think you need to collect knowledge from a wide range of areas. I think a good textbook to start with is it's called Endurance Training Science and Practice, I believe, by Inigo Mujica. Yeah. So that's a really good kind of starting point. And then I think you need to kind of immerse yourself a little bit. So things like there's a website called ResearchGate, which is really useful. So it's, most people that are publishing will put their articles on there. And if you contact them, they'll happily send you those articles. And then you get kind of recommended articles on top. So then you can start really kind of getting into the research, if that makes sense. Say, okay, I'll read this paper and then I'll request this one from an author and read that one as well. And you get a bit of a broader idea of the arguments and the concepts and where these things might be effective and where they might not be effective. I think also talk to other coaches. Do you know what I mean? Talk to sports scientists. Like people quite enjoy telling you what they're doing and what's working, what isn't particularly working well, where they've seen improvements with their athletes. So I think there's a good kind of community out there that are certainly, my experience at least is that people are quite willing to share kind of their insights. Blogs can be quite good, sort of webinars, all sorts of things can be really good resources, but I think you just don't need to hang your hat too much on one particular source, if that makes sense. Try and get that, as I say, that sort of broad resource base,
yeah,
and kind of formulate your own sort of ideas from that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, as you alluded to there, I think there's no replacing actually going in and reading the studies, and there's no one source for all the wisdom in the world. I've recommended Endurance Training by Inigo Mujica many times, as regular listeners will know, and also ResearchGate. But that's really where you will learn, like get the deep insights, where you start to read, like getting the feel for the consensus on a given topic in the scientific community. So yeah, it does take a lot of work, but I would agree that endurance training is a great starting point, and talking to coaches. I think Twitter is another great. That's how I found you, actually, and you post some really good, interesting stuff on Twitter. So if you follow the right people on Twitter, which is perhaps easier said than done, then you can get a lot of use out of Twitter as well.
Yeah, certainly. And I think then, once you've got that evidence base, you kind of need to get your hands dirty, so to speak, and actually, try and apply some of that stuff with athletes. Because it's all very well having all the knowledge in the world, but if you can't apply that knowledge and have that knowledge be effective, then kind of what use is it? So get out there and talk to athletes and say, okay, this is kind of what I've read, and this is what kind of the consensus needs to be. Shall we try this? And have that conversation with your athletes, and get a feel for how you can apply that sort of knowledge. I think that's also a really useful skill for, practitioners, sports scientists, coaches to have.
Yeah, totally. So let's talk a little bit about training structure. What are your thoughts around training structure? And you can tackle this, whether you want to start from the macro level with more high-level periodization, or even microcycle structure, is up to you, but perhaps tackle each of those give your take-home messages on training structure.
Okay. I think quite often people dive in a bit too soon. So let's say that, they start with a new athlete, and it's quite easy to start. You really want to get cracking and you really want to, help this athlete improve. And I think sometimes it's good at the start just to take a little bit of a step back and go, okay, what is this athlete's goals to start off with? What's motivating them? What events are they kind of working up to? And, what does it take to win is in those events, or what does it take to perform in those events? Have a look at that first of all and go, okay, like these are the, characteristics of this event. These are the, key performance indicators. These are the things that, we need to be looking at. And then do the same with the athlete and assess them, get some kind of baseline assessment based on those key performance indicators and say, okay, like what's your, might be endurance, it might be critical power, it might be W prime, whatever it is for that specific event, go, okay, like, where are we to start with? And at that point, you've got a good idea of kind of the gap you need to close, if that makes sense. You've got, okay, this is the date of this event. This is where my athlete is at the moment. How can I best close that gap? And sometimes you're looking at relatively short time frames, you know, across a season. Other times you can actually be looking at really long time frames, like an Olympic cycle, for example. Or, you know, even developing an athlete longer term if you're working with very young athletes. I think that's a really good starting point. So that kind of profiling of both the event and the athlete itself. And then in terms of kind of periodization, you'll automatically normally have some structure. So, you know, there'll be lead up events, there'll be qualification events, whatever there might be for that athlete, you know, and there'll be goalposts along the way that athlete has to perform at in order to be selected for or, you know, in order to get ready for their kind of goal event. So that's automatically kind of giving you some structure within that. And so you've got this kind of structure, you've got an idea of where you need to work. And I don't think there's any harm, or I actually think it's something you should be looking for as a coach. Like, where's that low hanging fruit, if that makes sense, in terms of where can I have the biggest impact with this athlete by doing the least amount with them? So that might be with their sleep, it might be their recovery, it might be their training, it might be their general life, whatever that is, you know, pick those things off first, if that makes sense, and say, okay, this is, you know, the sort of lightest touch approach, but it's going to have the biggest effect. And once you've kind of, you know, got the low hanging fruit, then you can start to look at specific kind of, you know, however you want to work with the athlete, if you want to, you know, block periodize, if you want to be more general in your periodization, et cetera, you know, you can see what's worked with that athlete, what has previously worked with that athlete, you know, what do they respond well to, what do they feel comfortable with, all those things. And you can start to kind of build up a picture and an idea of how you're going to go forward and come up with a plan. I don't think we should be slotting athletes into our own particular plans. I think we should be customizing the plans and the way we work as coaches to the individual athlete.
And how do you, can you give an example of maybe an athlete that you work with or have worked with where you sort of how you come up with for the given profile that they have and the goals they have, how does that then turn into some sort of, if you can make it a bit more specific, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Because I realize that's a little bit abstract. So a rider I work with, and I can name her, Lydia Boylan. She's a track cyclist. I've worked with Lydia for probably 8 years now, something like that. So she's obviously targeting the Madison event at the Olympics. So we did a lot of work around what does the Madison event look like? What are the power requirements? What are the speed requirements? What are the tactical requirements? What are the psychological requirements? And we've built up, we use a program called Goalscape, and we have essentially a map of what performance looks like in a Madison event through all these different, you know, through these different areas. Then we did some profiling with her. So what sort of power outputs can she sustain for those periods of time? Obviously the Madison is a very stochastic event. So, you know, you go hard and then you can recover when you're not in the race and then go hard again. So is she capable of doing that? You know, what does the fastest lap look like? What does an easy turn look like? What sort of speeds are we looking at? If, you know, if she's trying to take a turn, what does that involve for gearing? All those sorts of things. And then, you know, we had an idea of, okay, these are the requirements for what we think is, you know, kind of a very good Madison performance. And this is where we are now. And so, you know, we looked at some things, and the track events are so quick nowadays that, you know, power and speed, you know, the female athletes in a track event are, you know, doing a north of 60 kilometers an hour in their races. In the fastest laps. So straight away that means basically you've got to be on a big enough gear to be able to, you know, turn your legs fast enough and go fast enough to meet that speed requirement. Once you realize the size of the gearing that, you know, track riders are riding nowadays, then you realize there's a massive strength component to that, because if you've got to get that gear going each time, yes, you can drop down the track and get thrown in, but there's still an effort required, and you've got to be able to turn that gear you know, at the slower end of the spectrum in terms of speeds in the race. So straight away that feeds into, okay, we need to get stronger. Do you know what I mean? And we need to get stronger in order to be able to, you know, push that gear. So that's why you've taken a kind of bigger picture. This is the event. This is where my athlete's at. you've kind of, you know, gone straight down to, okay, here's a strength and conditioning intervention that we need to do with this athlete because we know it's directly going to help performance come race day.
Yeah. And if you have, like, you have identified a gap through that sort of profiling process, what would you typically, do you have any preference for, like, how to work on that? So in this case, maybe strength and conditioning, and I guess you're referring to a lot of work in the gym, but maybe you also have on bike strength work that you're including there. Would you more tend to work on that in shorter, sort of like basically spread out the work on different gaps that may be identified? Or do you like a more block periodized approach? You mentioned already that you kind of look a bit at what the athlete has responded well to in the past, but is there something that is typical for you in this regard?
Yeah, I think depending on how far away you are from a from an event, so if you've got a very short timeline, I think my starting point would be a kind of a block periodization. So let's do some specific work on that and let's see how that athlete responds. Do they respond really quickly to that, or are they not responding very well to that? And then we've got an idea of how much work we need to do, you know, in a relatively short period of time to get them ready for that event. If we've got longer timelines, I would probably introduce it in the other way. So I'd introduce it alongside some other training, and again, see how that athlete responds. So what you're trying to do, I think, as a coach always, is you're trying to build up a picture of, okay, how is this athlete responding, you know, and using that information kind of feeding forward into your next decisions. So I actually have like a little notebook when I've got, you know, a kind of a page or two for each athlete. And I just make little notes based on, okay, you know, such and such responded really well to that, or actually that wasn't quite what we were expecting, or, you know, that training seemed to take a little bit longer to come through than we were expecting, or whatever it might be. And whenever I'm, you know, sort of looking at, you know, planning an intervention with an athlete, essentially I go back to that notebook first of all and go, okay, well, they responded to this well last time, then, okay, we can use that, or we have to be a bit careful with this, or, you know, they don't respond to travel as well, whatever it might be, and kind of, you know, feed that into my decision making.
Yeah, no, that's I really like that. That's a really good sort of process to have. And then if we move down to sort of a micro perspective and talking about micro cycles, do you have any philosophy around how you structure the weekly, which might be typical, but maybe you don't use a weekly micro cycle, or maybe it depends? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I guess the one rule I try and follow is putting the thing that's most important first. So, you know, you might have a microcycle can vary in length depending on, you know, how much time you've got or restrictions or travel, whatever it might be. But, I generally put whatever's most important first. So if we're trying to build endurance, then the endurance work comes first. If we're trying to build a specific, strength or gym work or whatever it might be, then that comes first in the microcycle. I think with strength and conditioning especially, it's quite difficult to sort of program that in, and you obviously have to be quite careful with crossover effects. Obviously, if you're doing endurance or if you're doing more kind of what you traditionally call VO2 max intervals, that might interfere with the strength and conditioning in different ways and vice versa. So you have to be quite careful when you build these kind of micro cycles to make sure there's no kind of interference effects. And generally, that's why putting the most important thing first is, okay, then it's out the way of anything else that might interfere with it. You know, focus on that, and then we can do other things around that.
And does this assume that the thing you do first is also the thing that you're going to be the freshest for? So you assume that the start of the microcycle is when you're fresh, or is that just me reading into things?
Yeah, exactly that. So that, you know, focus is there. Athletes aren't fatigued. You know, there's no interference from kind of any other stressors, hopefully. And we can really focus on that and see how the athlete responds to that stimulus.
Yeah. And what do you think around, for example, a recovery between hard workouts? Do you have any rules of thumb that you follow, that one day of recovery, maybe 2 days for specific really hard workouts? Or do you like to stack hard workouts back to back sometimes? Can you elaborate on those sorts of things?
Yeah, it depends on the athlete a bit. So all those questions come down to, answering all those questions come down to monitoring the athlete. So one thing I have my athletes do is we have essentially a modified POMS questionnaire, which is point of mood state. And so we have, I think, 8 questions that athletes feedback to me on a daily basis on just a scale of 1 to 10. So I've always got an idea of, okay, how's the athlete feeling? You know, how sore are they? How motivated are they? How stressed are they? Those sorts of things. And talking to your athletes, you know, how did that session feel? How were the legs? Getting a feel of what's going on there. And then you can make those decisions and say, okay, like that, this athlete deals really well with 2 hard days back to back, or this athlete prefers 1 day and then an easy day and then another hard day, or whatever it might be. Likewise, with recovery between blocks, I try not to guess too much. So one thing I do with athletes is I have them in a recovery block. So let's say they've been away on a team training camp or they've just done a stage race. What I might do is give them a, you know, rest day afterwards. And then from then onwards, I'll ask them to ride for 5 minutes at 5 out of 10 or 6 out of 10 RPE and record their power and heart rate. Don't look at them while they're riding, just ride to feel and let's look at their heart rate and power response to that. And what you'll generally see if you take a ratio of those two things is you see an increasing performance as they recover through a recovery period. And then once you start to see a plateau in that response, then you know, okay, that athlete's now recovered as much as they're going to recover on their own, and it's time to introduce a new stimulus. So I try and be guided by how that athlete's responding rather than making a guess of they're going to need 2 days or 3 days or whatever it might be.
Oh, that's a really, really good tip. I really like that, and I might start using it myself because, yeah, as I said, really enjoy that. So next, let's discuss a little bit around deciding what type of training. You already mentioned or talked quite a bit about this, to be honest, with the profiling and the gap analysis and so on. But if we dig a bit deeper into that, perhaps you can just discuss the pro or like when to use different training methods or modalities, such as quote-unquote base training, moderate training, sweet spot training, threshold training, high intensity interval training, different cadence variations, high cadence, low cadence, high torque, so on. What and when should we use?
Okay. I think probably volume is for most endurance athletes, at least, you know, the underpinning of most, you know, of performance essentially. So volume of training seems to increase, you know, capillarization is probably the main thing you're looking at, capillary density in the muscles. And if you go back to the research, then you know, that's probably the biggest differentiator between athletes in terms of critical power, threshold power, whatever you want to call that. So there's a great paper out of Loughborough that just showed that differences in capillarization of the slow twitch muscle fibers accounts for 97% of variation in critical power, which is, you know, is huge in terms of biology. So, you know, that general conditioning is probably your good start point. So you want, you know, athletes to be fit, you want them to be strong in terms of S&C, off the bike work, general conditioning. That, you know, you need an athlete at a certain level before you can start doing any sort of fancy interventions with them. So that's always kind of the starting point. Is that athlete fit, healthy, strong, you know, and have good endurance? Okay, once we've got that, then we can kind of work on some more specific stuff. I think in terms of, if you imagine a spectrum between quite generic sort of interval training and very specific interval training, I think essentially what I try and do is move along that spectrum as we get closer to an event. So early on in a training block, it might just be about, you know, accumulating time of critical power and however we best do that, you know, just to get that stimulus of the high intensity work. As we move towards a racing block or a specific event, then, you know, those efforts will be more tailored to be almost a replication of what we're doing, you know, what that athlete's going to have to do in that event. So a great example, if I go back to the Madison example I used earlier, you know, if we're a few months out from the season, it might just be, okay, getting that high-end intensity stimulus, you know, time above critical power, for example. As we get closer to the Madison, then, you know, an average Madison turns about 40 seconds. So, you know, we might be doing like 40 on, 40 offs, for example. And I think that's both helpful in terms of a physiology point of view, but also in terms of a mental, psychological point of view for the athlete, because they kind of know how that, you know how that effort's going to feel come sort of race day.
Yeah, perfect. And what about, what's the role of moderate intensity training, things like tempo training, threshold training even, and sweet spot training, whatever you want to call them, however you want to categorize them, where do you see that fitting in?
I guess my starting point is always go for a more polarized approach. So, you know, a lot of kind of zone base work, if that makes sense, and moderate intensity exercise, and then a small percentage of very high intensity, severe domain intensity exercise. I think that moderate domain, you'd call it the heavy domain,
heavy,
so between the two.
Domain,
yeah, exactly. It can be useful for certain events. So, you know, if you've got like an Ironman athlete, for example, that's where they're going to spend their race time. So you can't, you know, it might be in your more preparatory block, so further away from the event, you know, you use that polarized system. But then obviously, you know, just to get them used to the event, you might want to spend more time in that heavy domain, or you might want to do kind of race replications where they spend time in that domain. So I think it can be useful. I think you need to see a little bit like how athletes respond, if they respond well to that sort of work or not. And I think my starting point is always kind of a polarized approach, because that, you know, the relevant research says that that's probably the way to go. But I don't think we need to be too dogmatic in our training, if that makes sense. Because yeah, it's more about how the athlete responds, you know what I mean, rather than what scientific literature happens to say.
Yeah, of course. And that makes a lot of sense. You're doing the specific training with, for example, an Ironman athlete or half Ironman athlete, or you do that closer to the event. So, you need to do that, whether that means that you're doing reverse periodization or not. That's a different discussion, I think, but it does make sense. And I totally agree that before the race, you need to do some race specific work. In terms of what you mentioned there about the endurance training, being the base training being the foundation of everything, and you need to basically nail that component before you get fancy. One thing that I wanted to ask about is for time crunched amateur athletes that have a limited time to train, what's your take on replacing some of the endurance training with more high intensity and moderate intensity or heavy and severe domain training? Because that's something that I think is quite prevalent, and we just want to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I think it's always that's a tricky question. I think it can work, especially in the short term. So, you know, if you're looking at like periods of, let's say, 10 to 12 weeks or a few months, then it can certainly work in terms of you just ramping up the intensity, doing more of that sort of stuff. In the longer term, I'm not so sure how well that works. So I think without that kind of base volume, it's very difficult to see those sort of long-term year-on-year kind of improvements. So I think what you see with a lot of athletes is, you know, you can kind of get them to a really good point in let's say 10 to 12 weeks with a lot of high intensity work. And then after that, it's very difficult to carry on those sort of gains. But you are where you are with those athletes. You know what I mean? They have a full-time job, they have busy families, whatever else. So you kind of have to make the best of what time they have available. Something that has kind of worked well for me with athletes in the past is saying to them, okay, look, it is what it is. Like, this is the time you've got available. We'll use that as best we can. It probably is, you know, pushing things into, you know, do more high intensity work. However, is there a point where we can actually, you know, do some real volume? So maybe even if it's a week or if it's 4 days across a weekend, you know, a long weekend or whatever it might be, can we block that aside? And, you know, can you fit that into your schedule to take those 4 days and we'll just do a volume block in those 4 days? So, you know, with time crunched athletes or age groupers, then, you know, you need to work around their daily lives, because obviously they can't, you know, they can't change those things, and do the best you can with what you have available, really.
Yeah, perfect. And coming back a bit to the profiling and the gap analysis, what different ways or methods do you use to assess that their profiles and the gaps that may exist? Do you tend to use field tests, different metabolic tests, performance tests, or what different tools do you have in your toolbox there?
Yeah, generally I go to is field testing, just because I work with most of my athletes remotely. And so, you know, we'll always do a field test, even if we can do more. So if we can get them in the lab to do some more specific testing, then we'll always still do a field test. So we've got a baseline value for any future test that we do down the line, if, you know, we can't get them back to the lab or whatever, if they're away at training camps. So we'll always do some field testing. Generally, that's a critical power test that I do with athletes. We have, together with a guy called Tim Podlegar, who's a nutritionist that I work with, we've come up with a nutritional questionnaire that we send to athletes to see, you know, how well they understand what they need to do after training, in training, all that sort of thing, before training, obviously, as well. So we have that. We have a sleep questionnaire to see how they're recovering off the bike, if they're nap using naps, how well they're sleeping, that sort of thing. Together with a woman called Josie Perry, who's a sports psychologist, she's come up with what we call a TOPS assessment. So a tools of performance strategies. So essentially that's looking at how well people can control their motivation, control their emotions in both kind of training and in racing. And we use that to essentially do some kind of sports psychology interventions with them. And then we have an S&C kind of core body weight assessment tool as well that we use. So we get quite, even just from kind of field testing, so that's all that's without getting athletes to the lab, we get a good kind of 360 picture of what's going on with each athlete and where those, you know, that low hanging fruit is, if that makes sense. So you might have an athlete that's performing brilliantly in training, you know, they're really strong numbers, they're sleeping well, they're recovering well, but if they can't hold it together on race day and then let their emotions get the best of them, then they're just not going to perform. And it's like, okay, well, actually, we just need to keep doing what you're doing with the rest and then focus our energy on kind of, you know, maybe some kind of sports psychology interventions. So that's kind of, you know, that's our, in inverted commas, our basic profiling, if that makes sense. And then if we can, if we do more, we'll actually do some lab testing. So looking at that, you know, one of the things we struggle to do in the field is get a feel for where the border between moderate and heavy intensity domain is. So we'll do some, you know, kind of lab testing to do that. We'll maybe look at efficiency in the lab. So that's something that, you know, you don't pick out from field testing. And also we've done a lot of wind tunnel testing with athletes to get an idea of, you know, wind tunnel and biomechanics combined, actually, to get an idea of how well they're functioning on the bike and how, you know, how that's affecting their aerodynamic profile.
Yeah, that's a great overview. And in terms of the critical power test, a couple of follow-ups on that. What durations do you tend to prefer there for that test? And also, can you explain why you prefer the critical power test above some other common tests that might be, for example, just a 20-minute TT? And why you prefer the critical power test?
Yeah, sure. So I use a protocol that was developed by the guys at the EIS for use at British Cycling, which is basically a warm-up, a 3-minute time trial where people try and put out as much power as they can within that 3 minutes. Then we have 30 minutes of break where riders actually get off their bikes. We have 10 minutes re-warming up and then a 12-minute effort at the end. And we use that to derive both critical power and W prime. Where I think that has advantages over, let's say, you know, a traditional 20-minute test is that we don't know from a 20-minute test kind of where that, you know, where that threshold is. People obviously take 95% of that, but that's just a guess and it's in population average potentially. So with a critical power test, we have obviously two components that we get out of that test, critical power and W prime. So whenever we do a training intervention with an athlete, we know that, okay, if we measure again, we've got two measures. So we can see, has there been an increase in critical power or has there been an increase in W prime, or, you know, we've got two measures to kind of assess them by. If we just do a 20-minute test, all we're taking is their 20-minute power and seeing if that's improving. And so if you take, for example, track events, so let's look at scratch race on the track. Actually, for elite athletes, a scratch race is a pretty easy race until about five laps to go. You know, generally, especially, you know, it doesn't tend to be too aggressive, and even if it is, the power requirements are relatively low. So an event like that, W prime is a major kind of key performance indicator because they need that, you know, five lap, six lap, whatever it is, power available to them. And so if we just did a traditional 20-minute test, we might not see, you know, we might be improving their critical power or their threshold. But actually then, you know, in thinking that we're on the right track, but we might actually be missing the one thing that we need to improve. So that's why where I think a critical power test gives you more information and kind of more actionable information going forward.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you have some, you can be more granular with what you're actually targeting and how you're measuring it and making sure that you're actually seeing the changes that you're trying to induce.
So, yeah, exactly.
So let's move on to another topic here. I want to talk a little bit about pacing, and in particular here, talking about more things like time trials or fairly steady state races for amateurs, things like, it could even be things like gravel races. Obviously, a large part of the audience is triathletes, so it's a form of time trial, steady state race, that too. But there are many, many forms of steady state races where you're racing more yourself than you're following race dynamics, on the amateur side in particular. So what advice and thoughts do you have around pacing?
I think pacing is crucial. Pacing is actioning sort of all that work that you've done over years and months and weeks coming into the event. So if you don't get your pacing right, then you're not kind of maximizing your potential. Obviously, you know, I think each athlete for each course needs an individual pacing strategy based on their kind of, you know, their physiology and the demands of that course. I think things like, so obviously best bike split will kind of provide that for you a little bit. And I think that's a really good starting point. Quite often it needs a bit of tweaking. So, you know, it might not quite match the physiology of the rider or the strengths and weaknesses of that rider. But it at least provides a really good starting point about, you know, kind of conditions where you might need to push on a little bit, where you can save energy and not kind of lose speed and still maximize your results. So I think pacing is about delivering performance. I think one other thing to mention is it needs to be practiced. So you can't just expect to turn up on race day and get your pacing perfect. Do you know what I mean? It needs to be practiced in training. And that's where, you know, in the events leading up to a major event or in training, you know, you need to have sessions where you're practicing that pacing and executing that pacing. And I think that's really important because come race day, you probably need a little bit of flexibility in your pacing strategy. You know what I mean? Conditions might not be quite how you expect, or you might be feeling slightly better or slightly worse than you expected. And so to have that flexibility and know what to do in those circumstances and not just have this, you know, you have to do 307 watts for, you know, on this stretch of road, like what's your kind of flexibility in that pacing strategy? You can only kind of make those decisions when you've practiced that pacing and you're comfortable with that pacing, you know how you respond. So pacing is something that really should be thought about quite early on in order to kind of get those sessions in there where you can practice it and so you can get it right on race day.
Yeah. To give you an example, let's say you're preparing for a 40K TT. What would a key workout to practice your pacing strategy be leading up to that event?
Yeah, so we might. So let's say 40K TT, let's say that, you know, headwind one way, tailwind in the other direction, or, you know, some climbs or some rollers. Obviously, if it's slower speeds, you know, you get more bang for your buck in terms of power output. So if you're going up a climb, it's actually a little bit better to push on there because obviously, you know, you're not, you're overcoming gravity rather than wind resistance to a bigger degree. Therefore, you know, that scales linearly rather than quadratically like air resistance does. So, you know, I might get athletes to go out and find a similar course near their home and we practice that, you know, let's break it down. Rather than doing 40, you know, K in one go, let's do blocks of 5K, for example, and let's practice that, you know, pushing on up those rises and then, you know, easing back a little bit on the descent afterwards, for example. And one thing I get riders to do is to pick a point. So, you know, point to point and repeat that point, repeat that section of the course over and over and get a feel for, you know, how can I maximize my speed by minimizing my wattage? So it might be their position slightly different on the downhill, for example, or do they stay on the ball, you know, do they stay on the extensions or do they go to, you know, the bull horns and get a feel for what works and what kind of, you know, circumstances. And having a section where you kind of repeat it over and over and over allows you to make those kind of direct comparisons much easier.
Yeah, makes sense. Also, regarding best bike split, so I also have used it quite a bit, and I tend to agree that the power plan that you get is a very good starting point. What I've struggled with, to be honest, is that I haven't seen the time prediction, the predictions being very accurate. I think it tends to kind of overestimate the speed you get for the power in the real world. Is this something you've seen? Or if not, perhaps can you explain how you make that speed prediction more accurate than what I've seen?
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, I think there's a lot of factors that you're guessing at whenever you, you know, these models work, but the data that you're putting into them potentially isn't accurate. So, you know, you're estimating a rolling resistance, you're estimating an air pressure based on, you know, weather report, you're estimating wind speed, all those things. So there's a lot of factors in there that, yes, they're accounted for in the model, but the data you're putting into that model isn't great. It's just a very rough estimate. And that's where you see this discrepancy between, you know, the time that it says you might finish an event in and the time you actually finish an event in. And in certain circumstances, my experience is it can actually go either way. So I think understanding that's a really important part. So, you know, like with athletes, I say, you know, this is just a model. It is just a prediction. You know, it's not defining your performance within this event. It's just predicting what it might be. Therefore, don't get too hung up on, you know, if the prediction's not quite perfect. All it is is a tool to allow us to come up with a good pacing strategy and give us a good starting point on that. Don't be defined by whatever Best Bike Split or any model that you use is saying. That's just a model to kind of help us make decisions rather than to kind of live or die by.
Yeah. I guess one of the main impacting factors there is the estimate for the CDA, because as you said, that power scales quadratically with the air resistance. So that's one of the main factors. Rolling resistance, of course, has a significant impact as well, but it's not as big as the CDA. So I guess just to get some idea for myself and for listeners, how do you have some riders, obviously, that you have had in the wind tunnel, so maybe then it's easy to just plug their CDA in. Best Bike Split also have their race analysis, I think they call it, so you can choose a workout file or a previous race, and Best Bike Split will analyze and calculate your CDA based on that file, which is what I've tended to use most often to get as good a CDA estimate as I can. But what would you say, if you don't have wind tunnel data, is the preferred way to estimate CDA for the input to the model?
Yeah, I think CDA is a bit of a funny one. So people get very hung up on what your CDA is, and obviously it is very important. However, any estimate that you're making of CDA is only an estimate in a, you know, a given set of circumstances. So even if you have people in the wind tunnel, you see a variance in how well they can take that position in the wind tunnel and apply it to the real world and hold it in the real world and how stable it is in the real world. So I think just a point on CDA, so rather than trying to, you know, chase a number or this is what it is at, whatever estimate you're using, all you're trying to do is reduce it. And you know that's more error, if that makes sense. You're not too worried about if your estimate's coming out too high or too low. What you're trying to do is reduce it at all times. I think, there's tools out there. So there's things like, there's a website called gribble.org, I believe. There's Golden Cheetah have their Aero Lab, which I think there's a new version of coming as well. Like you say, there's the system within Best Bike Split to predict. You know, you can always try and use a couple of these tools and get a bit of an estimate, you know, like an average between them is probably a good way rather than relying on one tool. But I think you just have to take that inherently with a bit of pinch of salt. So, you know, if the wind swings around and it's you know, it's a higher yaw angle than you were expecting, for example, that's going to change your CDA. I just don't invest too much in these models, if that makes sense. You know, that they're models, they're there to help, but, you know, they don't have to be perfect. They're just there to inform the decision making.
Sure, that makes sense. And going back to the topic again on coaching and evidence-informed coaching that we talked about at the beginning, I want to ask, what's one area of sports science that you are currently learning more about and that you're interested in? What's fascinating you at the moment?
Okay, so I'm lucky enough, we've just had two papers accepted and we're about to submit a third paper. So recently I've been looking at work in under 23 cyclists. So first of all, we did a longitudinal study across an entire season where we tested cyclists in pre-season at their training camp. And then we looked at their power files throughout the entire season and looked at changes in performance. And essentially saw that actually performance is relatively stable across an entire season. So it's kind of important where you come into the season. If you come in behind the curve, you're pretty much going to stay behind the curve. If you come in, you know, ahead of the curve, you know, you're going to perform well for most of the season. So that's one paper that we just had accepted. And then the second paper, as I touched on earlier, so we're looking at performance in the Tour of the Alps between under 23s and professional cyclists, and also between different rider categories, and looking at, you know, how they perform after given workloads. And that kind of leads quite nicely into my PhD, which you've been looking at. Can we understand that kind of downward shift in the power duration curve? Can we predict it? So at the moment, obviously the only way we have to kind of predict it is to, you know, have a cyclist go out and do a lot of work and then test them again. But obviously that's not that feasible or applicable in the real world when we're testing athletes. So can we predict that from fresh tests? What are the factors that are, you know, involved in that? It's obviously a multifaceted, you know, kind of thing. So, you know, there's going to be a lot involved there. But, you know, can we pin it down to this seems to be the main cause? And also, how, if we know what the main cause is and we can predict it, can we then improve it? And, you know, come up with interventions with athletes that are designed to basically make them more fatigue resistant. I guess it's probably the best way to phrase it. So that's my current kind of interest from a research and sports science side of things.
Perfect. And let's tackle a few topics here where you can give just some shorter, quicker take-home messages, thoughts, or ideas. And let's start with training with heart rate, power, and RPE. And by the way, I should put a disclaimer here. If you have a lot to say about this, then they don't have to be short. We'll just okay. Deeper into it. But from the outset, it's okay to just give like the high-level takeaway.
Okay. Use all three. Each one tells you something different. So people forget about RPE. They don't use RPE enough. RPE tells you lots of interesting things. So one thing I do with athletes is, obviously, I talked about the testing, you know, the kind of the monitoring I do with the 5-minute test earlier. That obviously includes RPE. But I also use something called the Lambert and Lambert submaximal cycling test. And that has all three. And the dynamics of change in each of those three tells you a lot about how an athlete is responding and what sort of state of fatigue they're in. So use all three and compare them to one another.
Training intensity distribution.
Polarized is my go-to to start with any athlete. So I think that's probably, you know, from the evidence base is probably the way to start. But be flexible and not too dogmatic about things. You know, if something happens to work for an individual athlete, but it's not, you know, it's not reflected in the scientific literature, there will be a reason why that is. But don't fight that too much and go with what seems to work with that athlete. Don't also get too bogged down in only physiological changes. So, for example, some athletes get a lot of enjoyment and they get a lot of confidence, I guess, from being able to perform in, you know, like those long, hard, typical sort of tempo or sweet spot sessions, if that makes sense, and actually come out of those sessions with, oh, I am going really well. And probably that boost in sort of confidence coming out of that session is probably worth more to you than any slight changes in the physiology from between that session and having done, you know, sort of a more polarized approach. So look at it a bit more holistically than getting too bogged down in one approach versus the other.
That's a great point. And rest and recovery?
Underpins everything. And I think throw nutrition in there as well. So if you're getting those things wrong, you're just not, you just won't be responding and adapting to training as best you can. You know, they're not going to make an average athlete elite, but they can make an elite athlete very average if you don't get those things right. So they underpin everything. And I think coaches need to spend more time working on rest and recovery, nutrition, with athletes than purely setting, you know, training sessions.
What are some key things that you advise your athletes on in this realm? Some things that you see that athletes might often get wrong unless they get this advice.
Sleeping. So people don't really sleep enough. So you know, athletes need. I think there's a paper out there that says that, you know, if athletes aren't getting 7.5 hours or more a night, then they're 50% more likely to come down with illness, which is huge. So, you know, sleeping is one of the key things that athletes need to do more of. Athletes probably don't use napping enough, or don't do it perfectly, so it then interferes with nighttime sleeping. So that's kind of a big avenue for potential gains with athletes. On the nutrition side of things, the kind of mantra that we use is kind of fuel for the work required. So, you know, what is your next what are you trying to recover from, and what's your next training session, and fuel accordingly. You know, if you've just done a hard training session, obviously you need to kind of you need to restore those glycogen stores, and you need kind of protein to recover from it, so they're your two kind of keys for your next meal. But what is coming up after that? You know, if it's another hard effort, then you're going to need to really up your carb intake. If it's just a recovery ride, you're only looking for carbs to replace what you've just done. One thing that we do with athletes is we have like a traffic light system. So Tim, who I mentioned earlier, essentially once I've kind of set training for an athlete, we've spoke about, okay, what are the goals for this training block, he'll go in and actually create like a traffic light system of carbohydrate and protein intake for athletes. So greens, obviously a lot, and reds, not much, and oranges, your average sort of day. And then we adjust those to kind of maximize adaptations to each exercise and prepare athletes for the next upcoming session.
Yep. And strength and conditioning?
Pretty fundamental nowadays. I think, you know, there's enough research out there that says, you know, athletes need to be strong to perform well. You know, even just for injury prevention and kind of general health point of view, I think it's really important. I've had a rider once get injured because they tried to pick up their bag at an airport on the way to a training camp, right? And that's like, you know, that was a week of training down the drain. So even for little things like that, athletes need to be strong. So that's kind of on a general sort of conditioning level, I think that's really important. If you're looking for performance gains through strength and conditioning, I think that they are there to be had, but the programming of that strength and conditioning needs to be really carefully considered. And there's some really good papers out there on kind of how the interference effect and the crossover effect between strength work and work on the bike or running work, and how, you know, you need to program those two things. So it takes a lot of time and effort to get strength and conditioning integrated into a program in an effective manner.
Would you advise doing some sort of like high weight, low rep program if performance gains are on the bike are what you're after? Would you consider the explosiveness, the speed of the movement, and in terms of if the focus is more on just a general being generally strong so that you don't get injured and such, would that look differently? Would it be more functional strength training, or, well, functional is a bit of a buzzword, I guess, but body weight, etc. Can you give some more information around that?
Yes, I think all my athletes have a kind of a body weight program that they do. Even if we don't have any specific strength and conditioning work in there, they'll all have a body weight session that they do. And then the athletes that have a more kind of tailored strength and conditioning program will use that body weight session as their warm up, essentially. I think this is getting a little bit outside of my kind of area of expertise. So I'm more of a physiologist than a kind of a biomechanist, or my knowledge isn't in strength and conditioning. I actually work with a guy called Hamish Monroe, who's a strength and conditioning coach on that side of things. So, but I think rate of movements and underutilized tool, especially, you know, the rate of movement needs to be matched to, you know, whatever that event is. So if you're looking at, you know, track sprinting, I think, you know, you obviously need some very high speed movements in there. And what you don't want to do is, you know, go heavy with your gym work, for example, and actually end up, you know, with riders that can produce a lot of force, but not potentially a lot of power because they can't produce that force quick enough. So yeah, I think focus just as much on the rate of movement as you do on the reps and sets and that sort of stuff.
Interesting. All right, and let's move on to the rapid fire questions. And these are rapid fire, so just one sentence. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
Endure by Alex Hutchinson.
And what's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
I almost don't have one.
Nothing. Right. And what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Whenever I'm stuck on a problem, I put it down and go out for a run or a bike ride or a ski or a climb or something, and then come back to it feeling fresh again. And normally you've come up with a new approach or a new idea or new way of tackling that problem by the time you get home.
Yeah, that's superb. Like it. All right. So, and finally, tell the listeners, where can they find out more about you? Where can they follow you and so on?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Twitter, Sprague_coaching. Or you can get me on my website, which is spraguecyclecoaching.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, James, for taking the time to come on the podcast. It was a pleasure talking to you. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Speak to you soon.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview with Coach James Sprague. As usual, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. On Thursday, we have another Q&A episode coming out, and then next Monday, I interview Dr. Bob Murray on glycogen metabolism and resynthesis, which is a fascinating episode and a topic that I've recently been researching and reading about myself a lot, which is actually how I found Dr. Murray and invited him on as a guest. So expect a really, really good episode. I was really, really glad to get Dr. Murray on, and he turned out to be an exceptionally well-spoken guest, I should say. So definitely one not to miss. If you're looking for training plans, coaching services, or similar, then we offer those kinds of products and services on scientifictriathlon.com. Super high quality. Go check it out. You won't be disappointed. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Take the free online sweat test to get a personalized hydration strategy and get 15% off your electrolyte products with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving craft.